Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
We are live. Hello. Do we have an intro music today? Is this out?
Welcome. This is Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. with Vaccine Rights Attorney Alan Phillips and Homeopathy World Community Founder Debbie Brock, who is back with us today. Debbie will be joining us in a few minutes, about a half an hour. I'm going to take a few minutes. This is Vaccine Rights Attorney Alan Phillips. Today is May 23rd, Thursday afternoon here on the East Coast, 1 p.m., and we're here every Thursday afternoon at 1 p.m. Eastern, noon Central, 11 Mountain, and 10 a.m. Pacific times. And this is a combined show. You can find, you can listen live at freedomizerradio.com or tune into Homeopathy World Community Radio. And let's see, we have tons of things to talk about today, and we have also coming on the show a little bit later on special guest attorney Greg Glazer from California, who joins us about once a month here on the show, and Greg will be joining us in a few minutes. We're looking forward to having him along with Homeopathy World Community's Debbie Brock. There are a number of things in the news, a number of questions people have been asking outside of the show, but you're welcome to call in live to the show to ask questions. And that number, if I can find it, is area code 347-324-3704. That's area code 347-324-3704. And we welcome your calls during the live show. But you're also welcome to email us during the week. And if you have questions specifically concerning vaccine issues, email me at attorney@vaccinerights.com. That's attorney@vaccinerights.com. Well, I had an interesting article come my way. It was actually about some parents in Ireland, if I understand correctly. We have some sirens going on in the background outside the studio today. If you can hear those, that is live and it will pass shortly, I'm sure. That a court in Ireland ruled that a 5-year-old boy has to get his 4-in-1 MMR booster vaccination, even though his mother doesn't want him to. Now, I'm not entirely sure, but I believe vaccines are not actually legally mandated. And the parents originally vaccinated and then split up, and the mother doesn't want to vaccinate now and the father does. Well, in these kind of cases, generally, courts are going to go with what the experts say. You know, the tendency of, I know if a lot of people here in the U.S. and probably other parts of the world as well, when they have these what I call vaccine custody disputes, the anti-vaccine parent or the one who wants to avoid the vaccines, and here in the U.S., the one who favors exercising an exemption, the reflex is almost always they want to bring an alternative doctor into court and educate the judge and tell the judge the truth about vaccines. And I certainly sympathize with that point of view, and if anybody ever does that and it works, you let me know. But I actually advise against trying to do that, because when people have tried it, it haven't worked, hasn't worked as far as I know. But also, we need to understand that as a general matter, courts don't decide the science, they weigh the evidence. And if you can find one or two or three doctors who will come in and tell the truth about vaccines, the other side's got the CDC, the state health authorities, or if this, in this case in Ireland, I'm sure other health authorities there, who are going to favor vaccines. And the weight of the evidence is almost always going to be in favor of the vaccines. And if there's any doubt, courts tend to rule consistent with public policy. And where we are right now in terms of public policy is that public policy favors all of the propaganda about vaccines that's been perpetrated upon us here in the U.S. and others around the world for decades now. We have talked over and over again about the documented lies historically and fraudulent information in recent and current times that forms the basis of current policy. But nonetheless, that is still what current policy is at the moment for the time being. So until we can educate enough people and actually shift policy to be something a little more sane, a little more rational, something that actually reflects the truth about vaccines, their safety and effectiveness, and other ways, much more effective and much less costly ways of addressing the infectious disease concerns, we've got to approach these kind of court cases from the perspective of current policy. So you really can't win these cases if you approach it in the here's why I think vaccines are bad point of view, at least not at this point in time. And so the court in this case in Ireland did order that the boy has to get his vaccines. And as frustrating as that is for all of us in the alternative vaccine community, it's a very predictable outcome. As to those cases here in the U.S., we've got a different legal structure because vaccines are required here where they're not required in many other countries. They're not mandated, at least in the same way, at least yet, in Canada, Australia, Great Britain. Some European countries mandate vaccines and some don't. Some have no exemptions from what I've been told. Countries in Eastern Europe have a really, really hard line on vaccines there. So it just varies from country to country. And, of course, the legal systems and the way you maneuver those systems is going to vary from country to country, from legal system to legal system. But here in the U.S., and this is a really complex topic to get into in any complete manner, so it's beyond the scope of a radio show, but I will say, here in the U.S., the vast majority of the time, and I've worked with family law attorneys around the country on these what I call vaccine custody disputes, and there are, in most of these cases, arguments that you can bring before the court to say that the judge can't rule, not that the judge may or may not, because in custody cases, generally, judges have really broad discretion. They need to be able to look at the individual facts and circumstances of every case and do what's best for the kids. But there are certain hard lines in the law. And this is one of those situations that while family law attorneys don't, in my experience, don't ever, I was going to say don't usually, but in my experience so far, don't ever come up with the legal arguments that I'm able to bring to the table when I work with family law attorneys. It's not because I'm any smarter than they are. It's just because I've been focused on this arena for so many years, and when it comes up for them, they've never seen it before, or maybe they've seen something like it once or whatever. It's just not something they see. And there are arguments available that you can take into court in most of these cases here in the U.S. where you can say, Judge, you actually can't, as a matter of law, you can't rule or order this child to be vaccinated, as the court in this case in Ireland we were just talking about did. So especially where there are religious exemptions involved, you have federal First Amendment rights, and that supersedes the state law custody standards that are, this is a state law issue, custody. foremost, first and foremost. So we're dealing with a state law standards where they have to do what's best for the child. But if you've got, for example, a religious objection, and by the way, what qualifies for that is potentially really, really broad. It doesn't matter whether or not you belong to a church or what church you belong to. If you do, what matters is what is your personal religious belief, and as long as your beliefs are religious as the law defines that, and that is a tricky area. So don't recommend that people try to navigate that on their own if they have an important legal issue they're dealing with. But nonetheless, as long as it's religious as the law defines it and a sincerely held belief, it's protected by the First Amendment. And so you've got arguments there. There are other arguments that have to do with what are called statutory construction laws that in most states allow one parent to unilaterally exercise the exemption regardless of what the other parent's wishes or views are. And that's different than the usual custody standard where the starting place is both parents have an equal say. One parent has just as much right to vaccinate a child as another parent does to exempt the child. And if you approach it that way and you say they have the equal right, then the judge is going to go with public policy and order the child to be vaccinated. So you got to come in with different arguments. If you're in one of those situations, contact me, put me in touch with your family law attorney so I can help you win those cases or give you the best chance that you've got to win those cases. Well, I saw something else that was fascinating recently, a letter from a couple of representatives in Wisconsin writing to their fellow legislators. They've introduced a bill there that would allow for a personal exemption of any mandated flu vaccine from an employer. And I believe this is Wisconsin. And the letter's fascinating. I don't know if I'm going to read the entire letter. It's two pages, but I wanted to point out, first of all, that there are some states that are trying to deal with this issue. And there are also several states that have bills pending right now that would mandate flu vaccines for healthcare workers. So there's efforts in both directions. And frankly, right now, the greater effort is coming from the pro-vaccine arena by far in terms of the legislative arena. And this is really a critical area that we need to be focused on and be ready to become active in. And the best way to do that I know of is to go to the NVIC's advocacy portal, and that URL is, or web address, nvicadvocacy.org, nvicadvocacy.org. If you're in the U.S., go to that site and sign up. It's a way that you can find out quickly who your representatives are and get alerts when it's important to contact your representatives to support or oppose a bill, whatever may be the case, in support of vaccine freedom of choice. But this particular bill that's pending now would allow for personal exemption to flu shots that employers may pose, meaning that you don't have to rationalize it in terms or explain it in terms of a religious belief or medical exemption, both of which can be difficult to get an employer to cooperate with. This letter from Representatives Theisfeld and Grothman to their colleagues in the state legislature says that employees should not fear demotion, retaliation, or dismissal for making a personal choice to decline a mandated flu shot. And they are specifying that this bill would only apply to the flu vaccine, but I think it's really interesting. I've seen a couple of references to people right out of mainstream medicine recently publishing articles or commentaries in established medical journals saying, in effect, that the flu shot is a bunch of bunk. We have people in and out of medical experts, in and out of mainstream medicine, who are essentially saying the flu vaccine doesn't work. We know from the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program that the flu vaccine causes injury and death. You can go look at the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program's website, Federal Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. They list the payouts per year per vaccine. And you can go look up the flu vaccine, and there have been several hundred people compensated for injury or death from the flu vaccine. And you've got to have a serious injury to be able to even file a petition in the first place. And only about a quarter of the petitions that are filed end up being compensated. And the FDA and CDC and the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons have all said 90 to 99% of vaccine adverse events are never even reported. So that $100 million a year that the federal government pays out to vaccine victims and their families is probably representing just a drop in the bucket of what's actually occurring in terms of vaccine injury and death. But it's established beyond any kind of doubt, medically and legally, that vaccines injure and kill you, and the flu vaccines fall into that category just like all the rest. So if it's questionable whether or not they work or provide any protection for patients, for example, does it really help patients for the healthcare workers to be vaccinated? Not according to some people who have done a critical review of the research that's out there and say that anything that says it does offer protection is skewed or bad research, research designed against the data, concluding against the data for political reasons or reasons of personal advancement or what have you. So in any case, this is just really good news. Now, it's my understanding that the state of Oregon already has a law that prohibits mandatory flu vaccines for healthcare workers, and that would be a great opportunity for someone to do a study. Let's look at the hospitals in Oregon. They have lower employee flu vaccination rates, and the hospitals, of course, recommend it as strongly as they can, but if you don't mandate it, you can expect lower rates, and they do. It would be interesting to see if there's any difference in flu working days lost or complications with patients and all the different things there. You know, is there really any difference? We've got a state there that we can use to test that out. So the representatives in Wisconsin are making some really good points. It's not unreasonable to raise a personal objection to flu vaccine. A random sampling of individuals would find objections to the flu vaccine for several reasons. Some relate stories of side effects, or some say just standing the ground for personal freedom issues. But legitimate disputes with the efficacy and safety of the vaccine are prevalent. And I think that's really a key point right there. Currently, if an employer mandates a flu vaccine as a condition of employment, a religious exemption must be allowed that protects First Amendment rights. But these representatives say they question why religious exemption supersedes a personal objection on this particular issue. That's a real interesting point. You know, there's nothing wrong with honoring religious beliefs and religious freedom. I mean, we do that and have done that since the inception of this country. But why would that necessarily prevail over someone's personal reason objection in this particular instance? And given the safety and efficacy disputes, I would have to agree with that. As profound a supporter as I am, nonetheless, of religious freedom. The CDC says flu viruses are constantly changing. The vaccine has to be formulated each year to guess which flu strain will be fought. So a vaccine may be completely ineffective, even if the vaccine works and doesn't hurt you. It may be completely ineffective because it's addressing the wrong strain. So there are certainly some years when the flu vaccine is 0% effective, sort of by default, because it's protecting against strains that are not the ones that are circulating in that particular year. So these are the kinds of things they're saying here. So kudos to the representatives in Wisconsin pursuing that. We certainly wish them all of the best luck and success with that. And let's see, what else have we got here? You know, there was a couple of other things. Let me find it real quick here. Here's an article titled "Vaccine Mom Has No Shot." And this story comes from the New York Post. And it says a judge denied a request by a devout Catholic mom on Staten Island for an injunction that would allow her daughter to return to school while the family's lawsuit plays out. And the lawsuit is contesting the fact that she's been denied a religious exemption. Now, I don't have any inside information about this case, but based on the information in the article, as much as I'm frustrated whenever I read about or hear about somebody being denied an exemption, this New York mom wandered right into the single biggest legal pitfall, the most common one that I see people fall into. You know, the people I have the most difficulty helping with exemptions are the ones who tried on their own first, get rejected, and then they come to me and say, can you help me? Because, I don't know, the vast majority of the time when people get rejected and then come to me, I look at what they've done, and they've done one or more of the things that I always tell my clients, don't do this because you'll probably get rejected if you do, or you'll certainly be at risk. And it's really unfortunate because a lot of people who approach religious exemptions on their own from a very reasonable, common sense place will wander into one or more of these legal pitfalls that can backfire on them, and it looks like that's what this New York mother did. And in this particular instance, it has to do with the way the law defines religion and the fact that the law sees religion and science as mutually exclusive realms. And it's really unfortunate because there's a lot of parents who might say something to the effect of, God doesn't want my child to risk injury or death from a vaccine, and there's no question about it. Vaccines cause injury and death. That's a legitimate concern. The problem is that courts will tend to see that as a scientific issue and therefore not a qualifying religious issue. Now, we can certainly make the case that, oh, yes, that is a religious issue. It's an established fact that vaccines cause injury and death, and that's a serious moral and ethical dilemma, whether or not somebody should be required to submit their children to a risk of injury or death for the presumed safety and that it provides that child and other children. And this is the big difference between vaccines and many other issues, GMOs or other kinds of toxins and so forth, where people say, you know, I should have a right to decide what I put in my body. And the argument against that with vaccines is that, well, vaccines are different because with a vaccine, what you're putting in your body supposedly protects, you know, everybody else too. And that's because of this herd immunity theory that says you have to get whatever the number is, 90, 95, 99, you know, it started early, and over the years they keep raking it higher and higher as outbreaks keep happening in higher and higher vaccinated populations, higher and higher percentages. But anyway, the theory being if most people are vaccinated, everyone's protected. Well, that theory doesn't hold up to scrutiny for one thing. We've had many outbreaks in highly and even fully vaccinated populations. The theory just doesn't hold up as to vaccines. Maybe it's true as to wild diseases that you get most people contract the disease, develop immunity, and then the disease has a much harder time spreading or circulating around that particular community. But bottom line is, as it pertains to vaccines, the theory just doesn't work, and yet that's the rationale given. But in any case, the mother in this case had expressed concerns about the safety of vaccines, and courts will tend to see that as a medical issue or scientific issue and not a religious issue, and therefore it's not a valid religious objection. Well, on a common sense level, it doesn't make sense because I may very genuinely believe that my God doesn't want my child to risk his or her life for the benefit of other people, that that's not a fair and appropriate thing. God doesn't want us to do that, doesn't allow us to do that, or requires us not to do that. That's a perfectly valid belief that somebody could have, and yet, it's, in my experience, that's going to have a high risk of rejection if you do that. So, if someone comes to me ahead of time, I'll say, you know, I understand that concern. But we can also think of it a little bit from the analytical point of view, and this is the place where people, of course, won't get, even attorneys don't get here in their analytical thinking, let alone parents or other non-attorneys in their common sense thinking. And it's this idea that when a vaccine is licensed by the FDA, and for a vaccine to be administered anywhere in the U.S., they first have to be licensed by the FDA. But when vaccines are licensed by the FDA, that licensure carries with it a legal presumption that the vaccines that are licensed are safe and effective. Now, I'm not suggesting for a second that I personally believe that. I don't. I trust the FDA about as far as I can pick it up and throw it. And I'm a pretty small guy, so that would not be very far. But I'm talking legal status. The vaccine, once licensed, is presumed at that point anyway to be safe and effective, or else it wouldn't be licensed. That's why the FDA is there. That's what the licensing procedure is for, is to make sure we have safe products. Whether or not that system works is a separate question. But again, I'm not talking about reality here. I'm talking about legal status. And the same kind of rationale can apply to state laws mandating vaccines. The state legislatures are presumed to have considered, are the vaccines safe? Are they effective? Are they necessary? Is there a net benefit? All those relevant questions. And so when they pass a law mandating vaccines, that law carries with it a legal presumption that the vaccines are safe and effective. Now, presumptions can be rebutted, but here's the bottom line. You don't rebut these presumptions in a written statement of beliefs or in your stating your religious beliefs on the stand or in a deposition if you're involved in a legal case. You take those concerns to your state legislature and say, we need to pass laws allowing more freedom of choice with vaccines. And when we get new laws, that'll change those legal presumptions. So, but a lot of people want to argue vaccine controversy in the context of a religious belief, and that's just not a safe not a safe thing to do. Anyway, we are coming up on break time here. You're listening to Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. I'm vaccine rights attorney Alan Phillips talking to you from the Vaccine Rights Studio in Asheville, North Carolina. Joining me on the other side of break will be Debbie Bruck, founder of Homeopathy World Community, and attorney Greg Glazer will be joining us today. And we'll be talking with you for the next hour, hour and a half, about some very interesting and some of the latest vaccine and other related types of news. So we hope you will stay around. And in just a moment here, we're going to go to break.
You know the Constitution like the back of your hand. You've read books, listened to podcasts, attended lectures, surfed websites, and watched videos. You've made liberty your life's goal, but something seems to be missing. Stickers from libertystickers.com. Exercise your freedom of speech with the world's most dangerous bumper stickers. That's libertystickers.com. But wait. There's more. You can buy Liberty stickers wholesale. Get them for 99 cents each when you put 100 or more in your shopping cart in any combination. Sell them or give them away. They're great for gun shows, flea markets, fairs, outreach, and more. Earn extra money, promote freedom, and spread the word. Need custom stickers, labels, or decals for your organization or business? Liberty Stickers makes them. Go to libertystickers.com to order or call 877-873-9626. Libertystickers.com, the world's most dangerous stickers.
Get ready for the epic new documentary adventure ride of your life. Shade, the motion picture. A view into the globalist domain. And Embellus and Burma's film.
Nothing in this world works the way you think it does. Nothing. Governments do not operate the way you think they do. Banks do not do what you think they do. The police department is not here for what you think it is. Nothing in your world works the way you think it does.
We never let them know the new world government has been identified, and they thought they just cloned the world economy to bring in a worldwide police state, but instead, it's going to bring them down.
You have to stand up, speak Jacob, speak out.
See the motion picture. Order your copy of the DVD today at SeeTheMotionPicture.com.
This is Mercy. If you're listening to this message, warriors, you are the resistance. Warriors, you are not alone. There are pockets of resistance all around the planet. We are at the brink. Read about it in The Sovereign, newspaper of the resistance. Available now at newsstands everywhere. The Sovereign is a monthly 24-page tabloid newspaper featuring incendiary content about life during wartime in the age of Obama. Warriors, keep to date every month. Remember to read The Sovereign, newspaper of the resistance. Available at newsstands everywhere. This alert is for all you boppers out there in the big city, all you street people with an ear for the action. This is Mercy. If you're listening to this message, warriors, you are the resistance. This is Mercy. Mine will be the last voice you will ever hear. Don't be alarmed.
Want to spread awareness to your neighbors, family, and friends about what is going on in our country today? It may be things you already know, like the large number of FEMA camps spread around this country to lock up citizens like you and me. What legislators are doing to strip states and people of their sovereign rights. Or legislation giving states the power to force vaccinate under a declared state of emergency. Do your neighbors understand what is going on? William Lewis Films offers the perfect tools to inform our population about this government's tyrannical shift from a constitutional republic to a despotic democracy. Films like 9-1-1 Ripple Effect, Beyond Treason, One Nation Under Siege, Washington You're Fired, Camp FEMA, Enemy of the State, Don't Tread on Me, Blood of Patriots, The Ron Paul Uprising, even 9-1-1 in Plain Sight, William's first production, are all available at WilliamLewisFilms.com. Get your DVDs today at WilliamLewisFilms.com. Educate against the police state.
We are back. You're listening to Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. with vaccine rights attorney Alan Phillips and my co-host, wonderful, warm Debbie Bruck, founder of Homeopathy World Community Radio and Homeopathy World Community, is with us now for the next hour and a half. Debbie, how are you doing today? I hope you're feeling better.
Okay,
I understand you're a little under the weather.
Yeah, I actually had laryngitis all yesterday, so my voice might not sound like me. In fact, it's been difficult for me to sleep when you have a summer cold, and I'm using homeopathy to get through it and support me and provide. I have to hang in there and have faith that I will get better, like everybody does. But what I did this morning was I received an email from one of the advocacy portals, and I think it was Democracy. It was. Let me tell you what it was. Click here, it says, to go to, oh, that goes to your senator. They give you a button to go to your senator, to call them, to email them, and I took action immediately. You can find it on action.fooddemocracynow.org, and there is a guide to tell you what to say, to tell you what to do, to upcoming legislation and amendments that are going to be on the docket. So I not only made a blog, I encouraged other people to do it. I recorded the call to both, well, I first did it with Richard Burr, forgot to record it. So then when I went to Senator Kay Hagan, recorded it and uploaded it as a video to show you really how easy it is. For anybody out there who wants to make a statement and let their representative know how they feel about labeling GMOs, keeping it states' rights, and a list of about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 other amendments, everything from protecting the honeybees, banning GMO salmon, limiting payments to large corporation farms, and transparency in government. All of those kinds of things. There's a guide for you to just learn about it and make a statement to your senators to let them know how you feel. And it took me a couple of hours to put this all together, but it only took you a few minutes to make a call. So that's my advocacy work for today. And Alan, I hope you will do so. I hope you will make a call to the North Carolina representatives. I know you don't think that they listen, but if we don't tell them, they are not going to be able to hear what we say.
Well, Debbie, first of all, I really commend you for doing the work you did, putting that together to make it easier for the rest of us to do our part to be legislatively active. And, you know, if someone would have told me in my early adult years that one day I'd be a legislative activist, I would have been on the ground laughing. I had probably not even a real clear idea what that was, and certainly no interest in it. Somebody else deal with that. I'm going to, you know, party and live my life or whatever. But I have, over the years, come to realize that that's where the rubber meets the road when it comes to our rights, our freedom or lack of freedom. It's whatever is spelled out in the laws. And people will take up as much slack as you give them, in many cases go over the legal boundaries. And so we need to take time on any important matter to find out where the law really is, where are the legal boundaries. And if we don't like them, we need to take steps to change it. Because if we're not doing things to move forward to deal with what we want, I guarantee you that the people who want something opposed to that are already actively pursuing their agenda. And in the vaccine arena in particular, although every one of these other topics you mentioned, Debbie, are important things that we should be striving to achieve and deal with in terms of personal freedom and the right to pursue and maintain our health. But, of course, it's hard to do when the government is limiting your options to only things that are unhealthy, for example, mandatory vaccines. I will say that there are, depending on the situation and the issue, the ideal is to sit down face-to-face with your representatives, because those are the people who are probably going to get the most attention and be taken the most seriously. But the other way, if not ultimately better in some situations, is to have numbers. And there are many organizations that people can join online, and they'll send around notices, here's a current issue, and go to our website and sign a petition or click a few buttons, and they'll automatically send emails to your representatives for you and that sort of thing. And those things are terrific, great to do that. But if you've got an issue where you don't have large numbers of people, it's probably best to sit down face-to-face. But I tell you, sending an email or writing a letter is a lot better than nothing at all. And making a phone call, I think, is even better than those two more often than not. And if possible, sitting down face-to-face, it's really hard for somebody not to give you their attention if you're across the table from them face-to-face. So these are all things that can be effective, and with different levels of effectiveness depending on what the particular issue is. But we have a couple of other callers here, Debbie. Greg Glazer,
hello.
I believe, is on the line, and we're going to bring Greg in just a little bit.
Okay. Do you want to talk some more? I'll tell you what, we have a conversation
going.
This is
Dr. Bob here.
Hi, Dr. Bob. How are you doing?
Hi. I'm doing good. How are you,
Alan? Do you have something to tell the folks out there on Freedomizer Radio?
I'm doing fine, Bob. Glad to have you on.
Good. Well, I wanted to bring up something that has really been stuck in my craw for a few days now. It's been making the circulation across many news media, and that is this recent paper published by Peter Doshi, Dr. Peter Doshi, in the British Medical Journal last week, where he is a full professor of pathology at Johns Hopkins University, probably the holy grail of medical science in the world. And he goes into tremendous detail. I actually downloaded the paper from the BMJ, that the influenza vaccine is a complete sham. a total farce and is something that simply defies every principle and tenet of good science. And this really, as I said, gave me a jolt. I'm a scientist. And as a scientist, the one thing that we all revere is the fact of how tough we are on each other. You submit a paper sometimes three or four times before it'll be accepted because some anonymous reviewer will come back and say your statistics isn't sound, your experiment size wasn't large enough, you're making faulty conclusions, and this is what science is about. And this guy has a published paper in one of the more prestigious medical journals in the world that basically absolutely slams the influenza vaccine, goes into all the details of the 135 million doses in the United States that are pushed by the government, by the pharmaceutical companies, and basically presents the data showing that, for example, you know, one of the things that you hear on the radio, on the TV, you see advertisements, my university sends out 1,000 emails to everybody, is that particularly if you are predisposed to chronic diseases, the old, infirm people, they might have a cardiac problem, they might have diabetes and high blood pressure, that it is absolutely essential, necessary that you get that vaccine. And of course, here at the university, it's for free. Get in line for an hour and they'll jab you. And then he goes into the data, basically, and again, I talk about peer-reviewed data, showing there's absolutely no statistical difference in the morbidity or mortality of elderly or predisposed people, of those who take the vaccine and those who don't take the vaccine. And I guess I'll shut up, but I am how is the world getting away with this? You know, he goes into the article saying that it's money and it's money and it's money and it's butt covering by the government. But I'm becoming impressed that this has to be the poorest science I have ever witnessed in my life.
So I infer from what you're saying, and forgive me if I'm delaying for the obvious here, but you are in general agreement with the position on this article?
I am in total agreement.
Okay, okay.
I'm looking at his statistics. I'm looking at what he is saying, and I'm telling you, I'm in shock. I mean, you know, there's all kinds of stuff that comes out, you know, in the vegetarian magazines and all you crazy wackos out there like me, okay? But when this is published in the Journal of the British Medical Association, it's a peer-reviewed article, and it's being written by a full professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, okay, the keeper of the grail, there's something very, very amiss in the state of Denmark here, folks. If half of what he is saying is true, this has to be one of the biggest hoaxes ever foisted in the medical community in history. In addition, it goes on to talk about the adverse effects that go on up to and including death from these vaccinations. And basically, there's no proof that it does anything.
Well, this is the basic chant that many people in the alternative vaccine community have been asserting for years and years and years, one version or another of the story. And what is fascinating to me about just recently with the flu vaccine is that we see this coming out about the flu vaccine. There are even people who have qualified their position as saying, hey, I don't have any problem with vaccines, but what's going on with the flu vaccine? I know SIDRAP, which was folks from the University of Minnesota, I think.
Right. Right.
You know, have been taking that general sort of position. And I don't know if they're just being careful to try and cover their butts so that they don't come across as anti-vaccine or protecting their – because as we saw, for example, in Andrew Wakefield is the classic example of a doctor who didn't even actually speak out against vaccines initially. All he was saying is we need to do more research here, and he got – viciously attacked.
He became the scapegoat for the past decade.
Yeah,
he's the scapegoat
somebody,
for the past decade, and his name is in the news again.
Eternally.
I'll let you, go ahead.
Eternally. And you know, continually used again to say, here's why we're having all the vaccine problems that we're having and all these diseases we're having are because of Dr. Wakefield for some reason. So,
that's
yeah.
Right, blaming it on him.
But what's actually happened, I think, long-term with him is that he's been a catalyst for awareness and awakening on the issue, and I think that's ultimately what will be the net result. But they certainly have gotten a lot of mileage from the pro-vaccine arena. Well, we have lots of evidence and more coming out about serious problems in the medical publishing industry itself as a whole. There have always been some number or percentage of studies that are withdrawn with flaws or occasionally because of fraud or whatever. But the incidence of that, from what I have read in recent months, has been steadily increasing over recent years. So either the problem's gotten worse or the policing of it's gotten better, but whatever, or a combination. But whatever it is, the problem appears to be overall getting worse. We had Dr. Marcia Angell with Harvard University, who was an editor, with the New England Journal of Medicine for 20 years. And she went public in 2008 saying we could no longer trust the medical literature. I mean, she went so far as just to make a sweeping statement. The influence of money has such a far-reaching effect on the quality of published medical research that she just flat out said we can no longer trust the published medical literature.
Yeah, but Alan, I think that this goes an entire step further is what I'm talking about here. What this article is saying from the Hopkins scientist is that, you know, it's one thing to publish bad data, fraud, fudged data, things like that. And I would agree with you, being a scientist, that there does seem to be more of that going on. What he is claiming here is there is no data. Okay? He says to the CDC, he says to Merck, show me the proof that if we hand out, and by the way, I just made the calculation, we're talking about $5.9 billion in sales just in the United States for the influenza vaccine. We're not talking about the other 60 shots you get. Just for the influenza vaccine, present any kind of peer-reviewed data that this has a benefit, that there is one group, two groups, old, young, sick, whatever, that really should get this because there's a 30, a 50, a 70% reduction in morbidity and mortality. And he says he's looked at the peer-reviewed data that's out there, and every one of them says there's no effect. Okay? P does not equal 0.01. P equals nothing. There is no correlation between taking the influenza vaccine and the incidence of morbidity and mortality in the target populations within the United States of America.
So
how
so
then is this allowed by FDA and everybody else? I mean, this seems to be the biggest. If this is true, okay, I have never seen fraud on this broad a basis that it deals with 135 million people in the United States, at least in my career.
Can I say something?
Sure, and then I got a question for Dr. Bob, and I want to bring Greg in on this too because I bet he's chomping at the bit here to get in.
Is he here?
I believe
is
Greg's
Greg
on the line.
Is Greg here?
Hey guys. Yeah.
Hey,
this
Greg.
Is a
thank you.
Interesting
thank
conversation.
Hey.
Yeah.
I didn't even know you were here.
Yep.
And I'm really also that Dr. Bob brought up this topic here because he's right. You know, what we're dealing with here is a study out of Johns Hopkins from a very prominent doctor here. And
yes.
he's making it really abundantly clear that what's going on is fear-mongering. That this is, right?
Yep, absolutely.
Right. And so
absolutely.
What
if you don't get the vaccine, you're going to die.
Yeah. And so he calls it, quote, disease-mongering. Okay. Now, where have we seen mongering like this? Have we seen it with the military-industrial complex? Yes.
Sure.
Have we seen it with religion? Yes.
Sure.
With the underlying problem is when you have a society where people become advocates for a particular position and they are empowered, become even extremists in their advocacy positions, you really have extreme results in society. Some of it becomes incredibly interesting, fascinating even. Even the way we destroy things as people could be very interesting. But the casualty just makes our whole world more extreme. And so I think that's what we're finding in the medical area. And, of course, we saw this coming. Oh, my gosh. The moment that there was Operation Paperclip to take Nazi scientists and put them in the United States of America, the program just kept going. And I think that's what we're finding, is that this is part of a larger agenda. We can throw around words like depopulation, which definitely tends to discredit what I'm saying. But I think that's what's happening.
Well, and this goes to the question I wanted to put out to both Dr. Bob and you, Greg, and I think, Greg, you've already answered or at least partially answered it. But the question, just to frame it explicitly, Bob, for me is when you look at how ridiculous the policy is, and the question you're raising, of course, are critical ones. How does something like this come about? And by implication, what is this saying about the agencies and entities that cooperated and collaborated to get us to this point? It says some very disturbing things about, again, the entities involved that set this up and to get us where we are today. But I'm curious for the moment as to whether or not you think or what you think would be the reason for their doing this. Is it just about the money? And, we don't have to look any further than the money.
Let me speak to that, because, again, I see it in other realms of science, too. Basically, what I see going on today, and an awful lot of what's done in science, is the reality of denial via basically deniable or plausibility of something happening. Let me give an example. I mean, and I'm reading this article as you're speaking here, Doshi's article in the British Medical Journal. Basically, you've got these, quote, and Greg is correct, this fear-mongering that is constantly on the front pages of the newspapers and everywhere else. We have bird flu. We have swine flu. We have HIV. The list goes on and on and on. God knows you're going to get MRSA if you go into a hospital and you cut yourself and things. And what it does is it gets people sensitized. And that's a reality. I think most ignorant people are going to be very frightened of the things that they hear. So who are they going to turn to? They turn to, of course, the government. The government, the United States of America, has a fiduciary responsibility to protect its citizens. We pay billions and trillions of dollars in taxes. We have the National Institutes of Health. We have the Centers for Disease Control. We pay billions of dollars to make sure that we are kept healthy. So then you end up with this whole vaccine dilemma, which, again, is just amazes me the more I find out about it. And this year is the perfect example, okay? We were told that this particular year, I'm talking about the one that just ended, okay, the 2012-2013 season, was going to be a particularly bad year for influenza, because of the strains that were being monitored out there. Now, that may or may not be true, okay? They came up with a vaccine. They made 135 million doses of it, and actually they sold most of that this year due to the fear-mongering. The flu season occurred, and what did they find out immediately? And this, I've never seen this peer-reviewed, but basically the vaccine they were claiming was an oops. It was about 35% effective, according to them, at preventing the flu, yet millions of people that had the vaccine were still getting influenza due to the fact that it was the wrong strains. I believe it was Hong Kong A that ended up popping out, and they didn't anticipate that. So what's the response? They have plausible deniability based on we did the best we could. The government did the best we could. Science is imperfect, and it didn't work. Now, basically, you're saying that I just deny that I did anything wrong because we did everything within our power to protect the American public. The thing that interests me, and I actually had a friend tell me this, they had the flu vaccine this year, and they actually were one of the few people I know that got the flu. I didn't see a lot of flu. They got the flu, and she looked at me and said, you know, I'm going to my doctor and ask my money back. You would think that there would be a warranty on the vaccine that if I'm going and getting this shot for $29 and I end up getting sick with what I was supposed to be prevented from getting sick with, that they'd give me my money back. So, of course, that's funny because, as you are well aware, the corporations are protected against that type of legal assault. They, quote, do their best at if it works, it works. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. We're still talking about them getting the $5.8 billion in sales. Then the government becomes the patsy, the sales propaganda. Okay, they're the ones. I mean, most of the ads that I saw, at least in my being around here, were promulgated by official agencies. The state of North Carolina, the university, the public health service, time to get your flu shot, got to get your flu shot, protect you and your family and everything. It is the perfect storm. The government, pardon my French, is protecting its ass by saying it's our job to tell you to get shots. So if you get sick, we have plausible deniability that we did the best we could. The health companies, the vaccine makers, that Novartis's and the Syngentas and the Mercks of the world who are producing this stuff sit back and smile because the government is selling it for them. And yet, as I'm saying, particularly, and you know, I'm focused right now on the flu because I'm not knowledgeable enough about MMR and all these other things that you guys deal with. But I'm convinced right here that there is absolutely no scientifically based evidence that would compel you to get this shot to protect you from influenza, and that there is a considerable risk of taking the shot. One of the interesting things that he says in here, I love this, I know Debbie will smile because it just makes perfect sense, is that, let's see.
And then we have to give Greg a chance to talk. I'm just gonna be quiet today.
I'm gonna say one more
on
thing,
station.
And I'm shutting up because I've got to get to work, and I'll listen to you guys. Okay, disease mongering. One study found that this is nasty. Flu vaccine 3 or 5 years in a row increased the risk of Alzheimer's disease by tenfold. Oh, let's lap on that one. Okay, basically, here it is. They have a product that both the government and the media will help sell for them. Since vaccines are protected against lawsuits, they are sued against any complications that may take place from it. So as I said, what I call it, again, is the perfect storm, because what it is that you have a organization of people that we can call the government who has the responsibility to protect you. Here, the companies say, we are producing something that will protect them. The government says, yahoo, we're off the hook by promoting this stuff. The company produces absolutely no firm data. And you're like, this was a real bad year, this past year. It just did not work. Okay, everybody knows that. Even the government acknowledged that everybody blew it. And, of course, it doesn't matter to the companies. They get their money anyway. But the point is that simply a metaphor for really what goes on every year? That influenza, the amount and severity of it, is not affected by the vaccine. Then another interesting part of this article, it says that a lot of people claim that they are, quote, getting the flu by taking the vaccine. And he makes a very compelling argument. He's saying, you know, scientifically, it is impossible for you to get the flu from a dead, attenuated vaccine. On the other hand, it will reduce your immunity so much that you will become susceptible to the influenza that's floating around on your hands, in the air, on the bathroom faucet, or whatever else is out there, which intuitively makes a lot of sense. If you have a reaction to the vaccine and you reduce your immunity, your system will not be able to fight the natural things that are out there You know, Debbie and I were talking last night about that wonderful article that came out last week. There's this kid sitting in a mud puddle with mud coming out of his mouth saying basically dirt is good. Well, yeah, it is. Okay, that's how our bodies were made, in order to have natural defenses against things that are in our environment. Anyway, I've got to get to work. It's great talking to you guys. But as I said, as a scientist, this particular article jolted me more than anything else I've ever seen. You know, you get people that are on the fringe saying this stuff. You take it or leave it. This guy is a distinguished faculty member at one of the most prestigious medical schools in the world. And he comes out in a peer-reviewed journal and says this entire thing is nothing but fraud. Somebody needs to stand up and take a look. Good talking
well,
to you, folks. Have a good show. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much, Dr. Bob. Really appreciate having you on today. And you're absolutely right. Hopefully this person will open the door for others afraid of persecution to join him, and maybe there will be some strength in standing credibility and numbers where we can actually finally break the ice on this and get this issue out into the mainstream and have some transparency on it. We have got to go to break here. And, Greg, I'm going to turn the baton over to you when we get back, I think, unless, Debbie, you have anything you want to chime in here with. But I've got some questions for you today, Greg, and if you've got things that you've brought to the table as well, we want to hear that. You're listening to Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. with vaccine rights attorney Alan Phillips, my co-host, Homeopathy World Community founder Debbie Bruck, and today's special guest, Greg Glazer, California attorney who, among other things, among many other things, I believe, specializes in historical research, legal research, and detailed research, as well as being very knowledgeable about present laws concerning vaccines as it pertains to emergency settings, martial law, and so forth. I'm absolutely eager, glad to have you on as always, Greg, and eager to hear what you have to say in just a few minutes after break. But stick around, folks. We will be back shortly.
Hello, everyone. Proof here again. I want to let you know about our brand new sponsor, Silver Leaf Tea. Now, as you guys know that have listened to me for years, I am a tea aficionado. I have hundreds of different flavors and styles at my house, and Silver Leaf has exactly the kind of stuff that I look for. I love loose tea, great antioxidants. I just love the taste of it, and this Silver Leaf has black, they have green, they have white, they have organic. Great for hot tea and iced tea. Silver Leaf Tea, it's right on our website, freedomizerradio.com. And check it out and order it. Silver Leaf Tea.
We are so pleased to announce ESP Botanicals is now sponsoring Freedomizer Radio. They have a bath and body line of products made for keeping your skin beautiful and healthy. But it's also for psoriasis, eczema, rosacea, and dermatitis treatment. They are meticulously prepared skincare products made from the best botanicals available. Committed to buying only from the growers when they can and using the highest quality cold-pressed oils, botanical organic additives, the best steam-expressed essential oils, and the least processed carrier oils that are available in today's marketplace. Pamper yourself or someone special in your life, give the gift of beautiful, glowing skin. ESPBotanicals.com. Thank you so much for supporting us at Freedomizer Radio.
Hello again, Freedomist. Proof is here, and I want to talk to you about a brand new soda maker called SodaStream. Now, the Proof House has had SodaStream for about a year, and we love the thing. We use it quite often. With SodaStream, you can have fresh-made soda in seconds. One of the big things we like about it is that there's no high fructose corn syrup and no aspartame. There's over 60 flavors, or you can create your own. Not just sodas, they also have iced teas and energy drinks. Here at the Proof House, we make egg cream sodas all the time. Some other facts to consider here, there's no electricity, no more wasted bottles and cans, and the most important thing is that it tastes great. Keep in mind, too, this is a perfect family present for Christmas, or, hey, just surprise the family with something great. Also, for a limited time, there's free shipping, So go to FreedomizerRadio.com and look for the SodaStream link, and I hope you check out the product. That's SodaStream right on FreedomizerRadio.com. Hey guys, Proof here. Guess what? I just got a cell phone. Hey, for everyone that knows me, I'm not a fan of cell phones, but I just signed up with a company called Solavay. And Solavay is offering a plan right now with unlimited phone, text, and web for only $49 a month. Plus, if you refer a friend or two, you get a discounted rate for everyone you refer for as long as they have Solavay, not just for the first month, but for the whole time that person has Solavay. You sign up enough people, and Solavay pays you every month. What other cell phone company is going to pay you for service? Anyway, go to Solavay.com/freedomizer. That's Solavay, Solavei.com/freedomizer. Learn all about it. Plus, and another kicker, if you sign up three people under you, you'll get another month for free as well. Plus, they're going to pay you cash. Anyway, Solavay.com/freedomizer.
We're back with Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S., co-host Debbie Brook, founder of Homeopathy World Community, vaccine rights attorney Alan Phillips. That's me, and today's special guest, Greg Glazer from California. Greg and Debbie, I want to ask you both if you had any other comments that you wanted to get in on the discussion there before the break, and then when we get to that, I've got another topic I'd love to run past Greg for his thoughts and input. And we still have the better part of an hour left here, and I certainly want to ask Greg if he brought anything to the table today that he particularly wanted to get into as well. So cleanup on the prior discussion?
Sure.
We have a full hour to go. Go ahead.
Okay. Oh, wow. All right. Yeah, so we were talking about the article, the paper by Peter Doshi, PhD, it's in the British Medical Journal, if you want to look it up. And he's a scientist at Johns Hopkins, and he was reporting on the flu vaccine. And we left it at how is it that such a slamming report can come out against the flu vaccine, and it's still so difficult to make change in society? And what I wanted to say is that our society is like a giant ship on the sea, and it is hard to turn it around. You know, it takes time, and in the process of turning it around, certain things can change the course again. And one of the main things that drives human behavior, especially today, is fear. And we see it time and again in history, not so much in the present, but in history of these pandemics where you have, you know, a widespread flu or a widespread disease like typhoid or something, or smallpox, and it just causes amazing panic, and our, maybe the modern equivalent of it today is terrorism. You know, the likelihood of you being killed or harmed by a terrorist is so small, but the amount of fear it causes, you know, to a person's psychology is great. I mean, to a point where they will go to even great lengths to lock doors, even within their own home, doors within doors. It's, I mean, think about that. It is a mind game, and if we want to get to a point as a society where we are taking the helm of our ship and turning it all around, the first thing we have to recognize is that it is a very big ship at present. And the second thing is that we have to acknowledge this history of fear conditioning and start to get around it. I mean, one of our main fears is that we fear pain, and we even fear discomfort on many levels. You know, we fear not being able to get all of our needs taken care of at the supermarket. We fear that there are other countries that want to take our country, you know. Obviously, we fear getting sick, things like that. And so a principle of getting past fear is that we are capable of having abundance in our lives, and we are capable of being healthy through peacefully natural means. And one of the ways to get to that point psychologically is with a humble approach. And oftentimes law, you know, in the field that I'm in, doesn't really gravitate toward the humble. It's almost like we don't even recognize it that much. We're more concerned with rights and due process and procedures and formality. And most of the time that's not oriented in humble. It's almost irrelevant to it. And so one of my goals as an attorney is to focus on the right to be peacefully natural and to explore that and share how that can really change one's paradigm on the law and on medicine. And so to take this one article from John Hopkins today and to turn it into something bigger, I think that first it has to be recognized as part of a bigger program. And to also appreciate that it comes in the context of the flu vaccine. Now, the flu vaccine has a rich history. When we look back to the Spanish flu of 1918, we can see that a lot of people died, and we can see that there's a potential conspiracy around it, that back in the back after World War One, or during World War One, the soldiers were given a typhoid vaccine before they went off to Europe. And the typhoid vaccine was manufactured by the Rockefeller cartel, which is, it's basically, a series of laboratories. That's their front, is that it's just a bunch of laboratories funded by the Rockefeller family. And you can call it the medical cartel, the Rockefeller cartel, whatever you want to call it. But the bottom line is that this typhoid vaccine was manufactured in factories in China that were owned by the Rockefeller and Rothschild nexus, and they called it a typhus vaccine. And what was it? It was a toxic and lethal thing, the vaccine that was produced by, you take harvested pus from an infected human, and then you inject that pus into a pig, and then you then harvest that mix with chicken and turkey egg albumins, and then you put that in a glass vial along with adjuvants, and you call it a vaccine. And this was given to soldiers, and then the soldiers go out and spread it, and then they come back to America as well and spread it, and they call it what? They call it the Spanish flu. It was this exotic thing that must have come from Spain, even though the people of Spain never had it. And we call this, it's a recombinant virus, meaning that you take from a human pus, you put it in a pig, and then you put it in a chicken, and then you mix it all around and put it in the body. That never occurs naturally. Nobody goes and mixes their blood and pus and everything with multiple animals. It's completely unnatural. And so it has devastating effects, and that's what happened. So this is the history of what is really behind this ship of society that's moving at great speed right now. And you got to start recognizing that. I mean, I definitely get the whole idea that, like, this is a John Hopkins researcher, very credible. But I mean, all of that, the idea that we need to invest in these men for solutions, I think is sort of a faulty paradigm. I think what we need is something radical, because it doesn't, I mean, even if we had 10 of these studies, 40 of these studies, which incidentally we practically do, it's still not enough to overcome societal fear. This is why perpetual war keeps happening, and why we have this gravitation toward resources that are ultimately so counterproductive in our lives. Try to sit down with somebody who's just like addicted to the Walmart mentality and just try to talk them out of buying that new plastic pool. You just can't. It's just this obstacle that, more studies doesn't overcome. You can talk about plastic, show them a plastic documentary, talk about, consumer lifestyle, talk about how, the psychology of what are you really trying to accomplish psychologically with that little plastic pool in your backyard? The idea is that there is an organism, a person who is gravitating towards something that they feel comfortable in. They feel comfortable on the ship. They don't want to jump off the ship. And the people who go and power the ship, that change the ship, are these, it's powered by both money and ideas. And when our ideas and concepts start to overcome this energy of money and the safety of a gun, then we will possibly start to make change. But again, because the ship is so large, sometimes you just have to recognize when you're on the Titanic.
I think part of the equation here has to do with the fundamental nature of human beings as social creatures. We have a need for aligning with and having interactions and being to some extent to be in agreement with other human beings. We form groups centered around common beliefs and common ideas, from anything from people forming a business to people gathering in a particular religion or other sorts of social and cultural contexts. And there are many people who identify so strongly with mainstream, and it's a comfort thing. I think you're you know, on something with that aspect or that point, that just by definition for a lot of people, if it's something from outside of the mainstream, it's wacky and not credible and not valid. And it's sort of ironic because every widely held and accepted belief today is something that at some point in the past was an obscure, rare belief or idea held by some minority. And granted, not every belief held by a minority is going to eventually find its way into the mainstream. Many of them do, and we, instead of shunning the minority views, we should be scrutinizing them carefully to figure out which ones are really telling us our own future, you know, which are the ones that will be widespread in the future. But I think that's part of, you know, you talk about the shift. I think it's a beautiful analogy. I want to bring in the word inertia, because that's sort of the physics part of the analogy, that you get something as large as a cruise ship, for example, moving forward at whatever, you know, 15 knots or 20 knots, whatever they might typically cruise at, and you're not going to slow that thing down by just getting out in front and putting out in your hands and pushing, you know. And so it's really hard once things are set in motion, when they have tremendous inertia, literally or figuratively, to steer it in a different direction. But let me, if I may, I don't want to cut the discussion short, but I want to try to get to some other topics as well here. And there's one I'm just sort of chomping at the bit to get your input on, Greg, because I know you're going to have a lot to say about it. Is that okay with you, too, if I push on to another topic at this point?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, go for it.
I'm considering doing another show tomorrow. because I have so much stuff happening, so much news is like right brand new, that I think I might have to do a show tomorrow also. I'll do it on Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Well,
what's going on in the chat there? I'm curious about the dandelion tea and the dandelion root.
Oh, you're what? You're in the chat? Yeah, we're talking a lot of, in the chat about garlic, because somebody wanted to know about allicin for colds, and dandelion has a lot of benefit. That's taraxacum. It's what they make tamoxifen from, and so it's got a lot of potent healing potential, both energetically, homeopathically, and as leaves in your salad. I pick it and put it in my salad.
Awesome. Awesome suggestion, yeah. I might just do that today.
Well, for those
I'm
of us
sure,
who aren't
I'm
as
sure
good at multitasking
and
who are only listening.
I'm sure it's organic in your garden, Greg.
Yes, it is.
Can I? Go ahead.
Yeah, but you're in California, Greg. Doesn't that mean it's also radiated from Fukushima?
Yeah, I had to get the help for that.
I wonder if you... Anyway, I think it's a fair thing to say. Now, I meant that in good humor, Greg. But
yeah,
I think it's fair to say that wherever you live on the planet, there's going to be some concern or concerns regarding toxicity despite our best efforts. And because we live in a world where we have ultimately one atmosphere circulating the whole planet, so anything that gets into that atmosphere that doesn't drop out of it to the ground will inevitably be all over the world. And of course, it's fascinating in one sense, where you think that every time you take a breath, and I saw somebody who had done the math on this, and I wish I could remember the numbers because it's very entertaining, but every breath you take includes breathing air that was breathed by Leonardo da Vinci or any other famous person in the past you want to name, because ultimately all the air that they breathe gets spread, and that we breathe gets spread throughout the atmosphere around the planet. So it's sort of entertaining, I guess, if you want to think of it that way. But Greg, there was an article just a couple of days ago. I want to read the title of the article and then read a little bit of the article. I don't think I'm going to try to read the whole article. It's rather lengthy. It's a little bit off topic, but I think it has some significant implications for vaccine issues, especially if and as we progress down a path where we might see more declared pandemics, or whether real or faked, declared risk of bioterrorism, or other kinds of things that sort of open the door as an emergency context to changing our rights as they occur and exist in routine situations. Anyway, here's the title. New, and I don't know if you've already caught wind of this or not, Greg. New federal regulations give Pentagon sweeping domestic police power. New federal regulations give Pentagon sweeping domestic police power. Now, the article starts off making a quick reference to Watertown, Massachusetts. It said citizens there know more than most Americans about the weapons, tactics, technology, and vehicles employed by law enforcement. In the wake of the Boston Marathon bombings, residents of Watertown were ordered by police to stay inside, then subjected to involuntary searches of their homes. This article, by the way, is written by Joe Wolverton II, J.D. So we know he's got a law degree, not necessarily clear whether he has a law license, but has some educational basis, if not experience as well, backing up what he's saying here, and it certainly sounds credible to me for whatever that's worth. But anyway, people in Watertown ordered to stay inside, subjected to involuntary searches of their homes. Besides the obvious violations of the Fourth Amendment's guarantee of the, quote, right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures, Watertown citizens were eyewitnesses to SWAT officers dressed in combat gear, using weapons, and riding in vehicles more at home in the battlefield than suburbia. And we have seen far more dangerous situations by objective measures where no such steps were taken or measures implemented or tactics employed. The article is focusing here on the militarization of local and state law enforcement, which the author here asserts did not make its debut in Watertown because for decades police have received millions of dollars in grants from the federal government, and as what he refers to as cash-strapped police departments and sheriff's offices have traded local control for new technology and martial materiel, which I'm not even exactly sure what that phrase is referring to, materiel, I-E-L. The blurring of the lines here, though, and this is where it gets interesting and disturbing, frankly, blurring of the lines between the armed forces, the military, and police forces has accelerated quickly, resulting in a situation where it would be difficult to discern fully outfitted police SWAT teams and the military. And he points out that another significant step in fully federalizing and militarizing local law enforcement was taken earlier this week when the Pentagon published amendments to the Federal Register affecting key sections that control civilian and military cooperation in law enforcement. Under a particular section here cited of military regulations, section that's about defense support of civilian law enforcement agencies, critical and constitutionally suspect changes were made, and this is sort of the bottom line here, I think, permit units of the U.S. Armed Forces to engage temporarily in activities that are necessary to quell large-scale, unexpected civil disturbances. I think that's a rather vague phrase, but the relevant revision, that military assumption of local law enforcement powers, is only valid in extraordinary emergency circumstances, where prior authorization by the president is impossible and duly constituted local authorities are unable to control the situation. But what bothers me with this sort of thing generally, I mean, historically, and Greg, maybe you have some insights that I don't in terms of where the law is on this, because this falls outside of my area of knowledge and expertise off the top of my head. But historically, the military is to protect us from foreign threats, And every state has its own state police, state troopers, or local police, sheriffs, you know, law enforcement. And it's really an internal matter of states. Now, we've talked about in the past how, with regard to infectious disease emergencies or risk and threat of bioterrorism, that we have the different layers and levels of government. We have local government, state government, federal government, international authorities that can deal with their respective jurisdictions, and sometimes those jurisdictions can overlap. If you have a serious infectious disease outbreak in a town in Texas that's right on the border with Mexico, that could potentially be both a local, state, and federal and international issue. Or if you had a problem at an international airport, that could arguably involve all of those different jurisdictions overlapping. But those kinds of overlapping jurisdictional situations where it would involve most or all of these different levels, I think, are probably rare, other than each level has the authority to invite in other levels, even if the other levels don't initially have direct jurisdiction. And so there can be local, state, federal, or international troops involved in infectious disease situations. But now we're talking about potentially getting the military involved. And Greg, do you have any knowledge, insight, understandings, comments, opinions on any of this, as I've said so far here?
Yes, yeah, there's definitely a framework in place for the analysis of these issues. Like, for example, a state authority, such as a governor, or a county authority, such as a sheriff, is allowed to authorize higher levels of law enforcement, including federal, to come and assist with the law enforcement duties. But there has to be an authorizing act that allows that. For example, there are federal statutes like the Stafford Act that will allow for intergovernmental cooperation. And so the governor can consent to have the federal government, including federal military, assist. And you see it with natural disasters. I mean, that's how you had federal boots on the ground after Katrina, because they authorized it. And it actually took a while. You know, if you remember, you know, one of the complaints the public had was that this took so long. Well, one of the reasons it took so long is because there's a legal framework. We have to approve this stuff and get the money. And it was mostly about money. It's kind of how it all unfolded. But so let's talk a little bit about what the Constitution says. So the U.S. military is prohibited from intervening in domestic affairs, except where Article 4 of the Constitution specifies that in cases of domestic violence that threaten the government of a state or the application of federal law, then the federal government can intervene. So essentially what you're looking for is obviously in martial law, that's an example, but really it's broader than that. It's just in cases of domestic violence or that threaten the government of a state. So examples would be terrorism, epidemic, and things like that. Now, during the Civil War, there was, this question came up, you know, and there was a post-Reconstruction law that was known as the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878, and there was also an insurrection act. And what they were doing is they were specifying under what circumstance the president can convene the armed forces to suppress an insurrection against any state. And what they found is that the consent of the governor must be obtained prior to the deployment of troops. So basically you need two things. You need an event that can be characterized as an emergency, and then that's number one. Number two is you need the consent of the governor. Now, the consent of the governor is often provided in advance, and they got it because of funds, needing funds. So they put these programs in place. Like, for example, structures are already ready so that in the event of the next pandemic, you have a hierarchy of command, where funds are given to hospitals to process needs, and the national stockpile of things like vaccines and medicines is then released to these hospitals to basically churn people through the medical system. And but on a purely constitutional level, the Constitution doesn't say what to do. You know, in times of crisis, presidents just lay claim to their extraordinary powers to preserve the nation. These are not powers that are granted expressly to the president, and they're not delegated by Congress, by the Constitution. They just exist in history and logic. You know, you go, like, for example, in Article 2 of the Constitution, it says that the president may or shall preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. And, you know, when push comes to shove, what does that mean? You know, it means that he's got emergency powers, right? Well, that's how we've experienced it. And so the public health powers are traditionally part of this, are traditionally given to the states and the counties. And so that's where I think we might see a great test in the future, to see who has the power and who exercises it.
Well, we saw, I think, quite a demonstration in Watertown with what the writer of this article refers to as obvious violation of Fourth Amendment guarantees. And then following Watertown, there were major cities around the U.S. Riding the Watertown wake, if you will, who were doing drills and tests. The idea of people being a local government suggesting to people that they stay indoors because there's a killer on the loose is not necessarily problematic to me. There's a certain kind of common sense, if that's really what's going on, and we could get off on a whole other discussion about whether the Boston bombings were what they purported to be in the mainstream news or not. But the idea of the entire town being put on lockdown and then armed policemen going door-to-door imposing on the people inside in just sort of a ultimately random fashion, you know, in other words, no sort of evidence to suggest that this is a place where the person they're looking for is likely to be or some sort of reasonable suspicion. It concerns me where, you know, and if we're going to add to this that the military can then come in, and the idea of the military being able to come in extreme situations where that would be in an objective measure needed are okay with me. I don't have any problem with bringing in force when it's necessary and appropriate and going to get a important job done. What concerns me is the generalness with which some of the wording of these kinds of laws are. You know, if a law says they can come in an emergency, well, what is an emergency and who gets to decide that? And how many kinds of situations can there really be that would go beyond the scope of what any reasonable state law enforcement would be able to handle? So do you have any thoughts, Greg, on the idea on the use and abuse of power as we maybe should or shouldn't, in your opinion, be concerned with federal regulations giving domestic police power to the military?
Yes. Yeah. And the answer can be found in due process. That's what we've looked to historically, and that's what other nations do with their constitution. So the even great violations, sweeping violations of rights have been upheld and not overruled. Like, for example, in World War II, when you had the internment of Japanese immigrants, you know, of course, we all know about this. This is the Korematsu case. It's where, you know, Japanese people were rounded up and put in concentration camps in America. And that case was never overruled, interestingly enough. And that was defended on the grounds of the Alien Enemy Act of 1798, which was a valid law during the World War II era. And Supreme Court Justice William Rehnquist wrote a book where he even defended that argument. And so what we find is that the powers are going to be given. I mean, you can't, like, unless you radically change the United States Constitution, it's a safe assumption that the President of the United States has great emergency power. The only question for people on the ground becomes, how much due process do you have? Like, as the president uses his emergency power, what checks and balances are there? I mean, this is what even the Romans recognized with their Caesar, is that they just had to put you know, he was going to be a dictator. They were constantly, you know, at war, except during times of Pax Romana, as they claim. And so a dictator had to just be limited. So they put, you know, they had dictators were limited to 6 months in office and that the term was not renewable under any circumstances. And so then they would have the Senate that would oversee certain of the decisions, you know, to make sure that these things were kept in check. And so essentially you have the same thing, you know, and there were still trials and so forth. So, like, for example, the Senate had to fund the dictator. So that's how they kept check on the military decisions. The president or the dictator was not allowed to exercise civil jurisdiction as a judge, so he did have power over life and death. You know? So what we have, you know, again, it's these checks and balances that were built into the Roman system that are still that are quite analogous to what America does today. And America has the checks and balances where, again, the Congress funds the president. And if Congress chooses not to fund the stock, you know, the release of the national stockpile, then it won't be released. It'll just stay there. And so that's how the people keep their president in check during times of insurrection. And the Constitution even contemplates the suspension of the writ of habeas corpus. Habeas corpus is when the courts don't you have no other remedy. You know, you've already been imprisoned, or you know, you can always do a writ of habeas corpus. You can even handwrite it on a napkin and say, "I demand release. This is unfair." They'll treat that as a writ of habeas corpus, and it's even that. Even that right, you know, the most treasured of rights that goes all the way back to the ancient days of Western civilization, even that right can be suspended under the U.S. Constitution, quote, in cases of rebellion or invasion when the public safety may require it. So, you know, it's these are rights kept in check. You know? They are as subject to the will of the people as they are to the will of the leader that people chose, you know? So we can look at, you know, all sorts of examples where the president exercised his, his prerogative to suspend the writ. Like President Grant suspended habeas corpus in his effort to suppress the KKK in post-war South. You know, that was
Rick.
Fun. Yeah.
What I'm questioning is the speed of action. So if the president has already gotten himself over the last couple of four-year stints in the White House, has increased his power, let's say over the past 16 years, we have given away our personal power, how long will it take before we go into a direction of checks and balances where we can stop the action of what we've already given, you know, provided via amendments and bills and other things? That's my concern.
Yeah.
Well, let me jump in here first, and excuse me for interrupting, but we're late for break here, so we need to take a couple minutes
go ahead.
To take a break. And Greg, can you hold on to your thought there and come back with your answer after break,
yeah.
please?
Yeah.
Terrific. You're listening to Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. with Homeopathy World Community founder Debbie Brook and vaccine rights attorney Alan Phillips, and today special guest Greg Glazer, attorney from California, talking, providing some wonderful historical and current legal insights into these issues. And I'm really looking forward to hearing your comments on the other side of break, Greg. Stay with us, folks. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
We are Critical Immunity with Larry and Renee. Our show will cover current events, national health news, nutrition, emergency preparedness, and organic farming, and various implements and tools to thrive and survive. We hope you tune in and join in our discussion of health, liberty, preparedness, and survival. Join our hosts, Larry and Renee, with guest callers always welcome.
Oh, you want to heal the world? Oh, you can't do that. You know, you gotta elect the right people. No, change your thinking, change the way you feel, change the way you do things. do everything for peace. Like John Lennon said, walk for peace. You take a shower for peace. Do whatever you do for peace.
Every time you do that, you set a ripple effect out.
Because we live in a vibrational world, and your brain is the instrument. To learn how to direct and control your mind, you guys are superheroes. You know, they don't want you to know that, but you are. You guys are the most powerful people in the world.
We see the power in you to change your thinking. Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday, only on Freedomizer Radio.
Greetings, this is Blake the Eccentric, and I want to invite you to check out my new show on Freedomizer Radio, The Eccentric Perspective. It's sort of a red pill, blue pill, going down the rabbit hole kind of show, featuring outside-the-box politics, philosophy, and gonzo journalism. But be warned, with knowledge comes responsibility, and you might not see the world the same way again. As I will attempt to open your mind, speak to your common sense, and challenge your critical thinking skills. So please join me Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday from noon to 1:30 Pacific Time. Once again, that's Eccentric Perspective, only on Freedomizer Radio.
When tyranny rears its ugly head, will you bow and serve? Or will you stand and fight?
Hi, everybody. This is Barack Obama. You get this hunger.
Everybody here wants the pie. We want to grow the pie, and then we want to fight for the pie.
When freedom is threatened, will you turn a blind eye, or will you sound the alarm?
The private sector is doing fine.
Hey, folks, this is The Mouth, host of The Last Voice for Liberty Network. Tune in Tuesday nights at 9 p.m. Pacific, 11 Central, for your ultimate dose of liberty, right here on FreedomizerRadio.com.
What can we get done right now?
What?
This is the politics of the moment. This has to do with what can we get done right now?
What?
Lindsay Williams on Freedomizer Radio.
Growth Negative, I love the title that you use on your radio. I've thought about it ever since we talked on off of the air the other day, and I'd say that's an excellent title for a talk show host.
How's it going, Freedomizers? This is Ferdinand. Join me on the No Bull Zone every Monday night from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We talk about everything from local to national issues, how to be free, and even throw in some health talks. Call in to chat or suggest a topic. That's the No Bull Zone every Monday evening from 8 to 9 p.m. East Coast Time, only on Freedomizer Radio.
Hey, Freedomist, join me, Proof Negative. Weeknights, 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern, 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. Pacific, as we fight the New World Order together. Right here on Freedomizer Radio, your exclusive home of the Proof Negative Show.
Hey everyone, this is Ron from Ron's Media Matrix on the Freedomizer Radio Network. Be sure to catch my show broadcast here every Tuesday from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you're listening in another part of the world, that's 1800 to 2000 hours Greenwich Mean Time. We're here covering breaking world news, current geopolitical trends, keeping you up to date on the latest science and technology, along with interviewing a wide range of guests, versed in a variety of special topics, and that's not all. Freedomizer Radio broadcasts 15 hours a day, 7 days a week, with other talk show hosts that cover a wide variety of topics, including health, current events, emergency preparations, spiritual interests, and much, much more. So be sure to stay tuned and at www.freedomizerradio.com. That's www.freedomizerradio.com. And if you're away from your home computer, you can always listen to us on your cell phone by calling 347-324-3704. That's 347-324-3704. And thanks for listening.
Okay, we're back with Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. with Homeopathy World Community founder Debbie Brook, vaccine rights attorney Alan Phillips, and special guest attorney Greg Glazer from California. Greg, do you remember where we left off?
Yes. Yeah, we left off with Debbie's question about due process in times of emergency, including even potentially the suspension of the writ of habeas corpus. And so the way the due process works is that it gives you the right to a fair hearing and the right to present evidence at your hearing, the right to have an impartial decider, whether that's a jury or a judge deciding, and you have certain notice requirements, like you have enough time to present your argument, your evidence, and so forth. Oftentimes you have the right to a lawyer, and some forms of due process include, for example, your right to remain silent if you want, the right not to testify against yourself, preserved in the Constitution. They all coalesce as what we generally call due process. Now, the way that each one of those rights is exercised will depend on the circumstances of the case. So, for example, if you find yourself in a state of emergency where officers are going door-to-door and rounding people up to be processed and either show proof that you've received your vaccination, your inoculation, whatever, or else you have to be shipped off to a concentration camp, then at that point you have more rights in your home than you do once you get to the concentration camp. So what is due process for you is it may be that you want to you make a petition to the particular board that is overseeing, maybe it's the county health board, maybe it's some type of national board locally. You make a petition that preserves your right to self-quarantine in your home. It would be a proactive way to avoid being shipped off to a camp. Now, if you find yourself in a camp, it may be the only tribunal you're allowed to go before is a military tribunal that's actually stationed there at the camp. And they're not likely to hear any of your evidence that you might have, about how you need things like organic food and you need, to not be needled. So basically the goal of a successful approach to exercising your right to be peacefully natural is to avoid being processed by that system, as we've chatted about in previous shows.
Well, and it's, depending on the specific situation, that might or might not be easy to do. I just want to underscore that the due process rights you're talking about, and gave a really terrific general overview of what that is something that gets potentially significantly changed or diminished, at least temporarily, in an emergency context. One of the examples I always refer to speaking about that concept in the law generally, the idea that some of our rights can be diminished or go out the window, at least temporarily, if there's an emergency, is in cases of domestic violence, referring to individuals here, where in the classic situation, a husband or a boyfriend is beating up the wife or girlfriend, and the wife or girlfriend in most, if not all, states has the right to go into court by herself and try to convince a judge that she needs an emergency protective order. And based on that one person's testimony, without the other side being able to come in and tell their side of the story, no, I didn't beat up this woman, or she's making it all up, or whatever their defense might be, the judges can issue a temporary order as long as they schedule a hearing within some reasonable amount of time, and it might vary from state to state what they actually spell that out to be. I think here in North Carolina it has to be within 10 days or 7 days, something like that. As long as they give the other side an opportunity to come in a reasonable amount of time to tell their side of the story, the judges are authorized to enter a temporary order based on just one person's point of view. And this is, for me anyway, at the same time, a necessary and yet very problematic principle or concept in law, because emergencies do occur where you don't have time to go figure out what's going on. As parents, we have a right to make decisions about health care for our children, but if your child is in a accident on the bus going to school, you want the doctor to be able to intervene immediately and stop the bleeding or whatever it is, if it's a serious emergency, without having to track you down first and say, is it okay if I save your child's life? We want certain kinds of authority to be there that in an emergency situation that ordinarily are not there outside of an emergency. The problem, of course, arises when that authority is misused, abused, or whatever, and I can't help but feel like what went on in Watertown was grossly disproportionate to the real level of threat in that situation, and that it was a violation of these people's Fourth Amendment rights. So I may have gotten us away from where you left off there, Greg, but I guess I just wanted to sort of underscore that whatever rights we have, as you said, I think depends on the situation, but there's a radical shift that can take place when an emergency is declared. And during the swine flu emergency, 11 states declared emergency. Virginia declared an emergency even though they had not documented a single case of swine flu anywhere in the state. But and of course, we now know there was no swine flu emergency, but when the emergency is declared, the legal landscape changes whether there's really an emergency or not. And that concerns me, especially if we're moving in a direction where we're going to see the military become increasingly active in domestic affairs. So let me pause at this point then and pass this back over to you, Greg, if you have anything you want to comment about that or take your conversation further.
So we have about 7 minutes. Go ahead.
Any thoughts or comments on that, Greg?
Maybe he's not there. Okay. Might have lost him. So I
oh,
wanted
I'm sorry.
To make all...
Go ahead. I was talking, but you couldn't hear. Okay. What Alan just said got me thinking about what works and what doesn't work from a due process perspective. So here I'll give you 4 things that work and 2 things that don't work. Actually, I'll give you 7 things that work. Okay. Number 1, invite your doctor and your lawyer to oversee your personal situation and provide input on your behalf. If you have a doctor in your corner and a lawyer in your corner, you will generally get treated better by any system, whatever it is, no matter what the time is. Now, another thing you can do, number 2, prepare your exemption forms ahead of time. Alan has a book about exemption forms. You and your doctor can work together to specify, you know, whether you have any particular aversions. Most people happen to be averse to things like mercury and formaldehyde. You can help document that in advance. So no matter what they throw at you, the next new thing, you'll be ready. Number 3, during any part of a processing, whether you're in criminal court, civil court, military hearing, you have due process. It is a right in America. So you can always make a formal request for due process. And in order to do that, you need to, 1, identify the law or regulation which recognizes your right or is trying to take your right away. It might be that if you're in California, starting point is, quote, the relatively certain principle that a competent adult has the right to refuse medical treatment, even treatment necessary to sustain life. You may cite the United States Constitution. You may even cite regulations that limit the government in some particular level for your situation. So, again, what you've just done is you've identified the law or regulation which recognizes your right. Then you find rules that clarify or interpret that right. This can be cases. This can be the statements that you find on a website. It's things that help put it into context. What you do is you apply the rules to your facts in an objective and evidence-based manner. Don't make sweeping cases like this court is out to become the new Nazis, you know. Make it very clear that you are making a request that is specific to yourself and that you're applying the facts to the law objectively. And again, if you have an attorney, this all goes much easier. And it helps to argue in the alternative. So if you have multiple independent points that support your position, and you just create like a, basically you create a brief, you know, like this local law doesn't apply to me because X. Point 2, even if this local law does apply to me, then I have defense Y. Even if defense Y doesn't apply, I have defense Z, you know. So you can see how you go through layers. It's like filtration, you know. You don't just rely on one source of filtration. It's your water. You stack them. And then you submit your request professionally. Never threaten a government official. Don't just use sound bites from cases or one-liners from legal cases. Okay, so that was the third way to protect yourself. Number 4. Get a media spotlight on if you're being oppressed, YouTube is your friend. Number five, try to stay under the radar and off the grid as much as possible. If you use and rely on government services regularly, then you are likely to be processed by the government when you are in need or when they perceive you to be in need. History shows that public health measures are directed at the majority of the population and are not designated to hunt down every individual naturalist. That we just see that historically. That may be the case in the future as well. So try not to, you know, over panic or overthink it. You just try to remain off the radar and self-quarantine, be natural, things might work out well for you. Try to stay positive. In the worst-case scenario, you might have to move out of the jurisdiction. This was literally the best advice for Jewish people in Germany before World War II, and it may be the advice that ultimately proves correct in the future. That's all.
That means get out of USA? Oh, boy. Can I ask you, Greg, because we only have a couple minutes, for the next time you're on, to repeat that list of how to protect yourself, maybe even elaborate a little bit more about it. And part two would be my question repeated in another way. I would like to learn the rapidity of legal change in our laws since we have already given away our power, and we don't have a good checks and balance system in the American government anymore. So in the course of between 1 to 4 years, how quickly can we set things straight? As you said, get that ship back on course. And so that's my request for the next time you're on. We have about 2 minutes. Alan, did you want to say anything? And then I would like to do a little promo.
Yeah, my personal opinion is the ship is too big and has too much momentum to change. I think we need to blow it up and build another ship. But that's just my own personal opinion. I'm willing to be proved wrong by that. You're listening to Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S., and I'm Vaccine Rights Attorney Alan Phillips. Have an ebook available at vaccinerights.com that can help you to understand your right to refuse vaccines. Greg, thank you so much for being with us today. Greg Glazer, attorney from California, always has tremendous insights to offer about vaccine and other legal issues and the history of law, which is fascinating. And Debbie, we hope your voice gets better and you'll be back hopefully next week with your regular half-hour segment at the end of our two-hour Thursday afternoon show, where you can continue to educate us about homeopathy and how that works in our lives.
Yeah. I hope so. go ahead.
I have laryngitis or something akin to that infrequently, but I'm a professional singer, and I'm always horrified when I don't have my voice working and functioning in top order.
Right. So, well, if I had been on, if it was yesterday, you wouldn't have heard a sound coming out of me, and it would be all squeaky if you did. So my intent, if I am feeling better and my voice has fully returned, I might do another show tomorrow, Blog Talk Radio, Homeopathy World Community. And I would like to promote the Health In show coming up on Monday. I'm preparing a document, an article, and I'm going to have a Dr. Isaac Golden will come back on with me. That's 11 a.m. Eastern Time, the Health In show on Nissan Communications. Just go to Homeopathy World Community and you'll get all the details. And we're going to talk about evidence-based medicine and whatever music rings your soul. I know that we have to get off here in order to get give time for the next person up on the air. So I'm logging out here, and you guys, Alan, put on the music, please. Can you do
rolling.
That?
We're rolling. So Debbie's going to sign off so the next host can get on Freedomizer Radio. In the meantime, I'll talk us out for a few seconds here. Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S., finishing with Homeopathy World Community Radio segment at the end ordinarily, 2 hours
well,
on Thursday
like
afternoon
still
at
on the
1
air,
p.m. Eastern Time on Thursday. We'll see you next week, folks.
Homeopathy World Community Radio, and we have
so many hundreds and hundreds of archives. Anybody can listen to them from 2010 to 2013. And we also have over a year's worth of Health In live video shows on Nissan Communications, which are broadcast through Homeopathy World Community. And I'm wishing everyone a good day, stress-free day. Get outside, go for a walk, get your vitamin C, your vitamin D, and your B12, and whatever you need to feel good. So thank you so much for listening. Bye-bye.